Okay, welcome to the Bitcoin Gauntlet, episode 11. Today, I'm excited to have on the author, filmmaker, Noster Evangelist, host of the PlebChain Radio podcast, Avi Burra. How are you doing today, Avi?
I'm doing well. Happy to be here, Tom.
Yeah, happy to have you. And happy to have you try the gauntlet, be a contestant. So, for anyone who's not familiar with you, if you could tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're up to in Bitcoin and Noster.
So as you mentioned, I'm an author. I wrote the first Bitcoin fiction novel. I believe it's the first one. It was called 24. I wrote it about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago. I've recently released its sequel called July 18, about a month ago. So those are my two books, working on my third one. As a filmmaker, I've started this series called Finding Home, which is a travel show inspired by Anthony Bourdain, food, travel, culture. But with the twist being, I talk to Bitcoiners who are expats building things in a new country that they've chosen, right? So they're finding home there. The idea is to play out the two parallel stories. One is fi their journey of finding that physical home in a new land, and also their sovereign home or spiritual home through Bitcoin. And then I've been on Nostr. In fact, today, the day we're recording, is my exact 3 year Nostr anniversary. I spun up my NPub, discovered my NPub, if you will, 3 years ago to the day. Oh, yes. And I'm the host of the PlebChain Radio podcast. My co-host and I, QW, we launched this in February of 2023, so just a couple of months after we joined Nostrum, we felt like there was something here which we couldn't quite put our finger on, but we wanted to talk about it and talk to people about it. And it's been running pretty much weekly since then, focused primarily on Nostr culture and Bitcoin culture, of course, but also interview a lot of builders and technologists. And then finally, I am a technologist myself. And I have a company. I'm a co-founder of a company called Nos Fabrica, where we're building web of trust solutions and infrastructure for Nostr.
Great. Yeah, I'm a fan of the podcast. Was listening to some this morning. I like the new feature with the song and the Zap boost payments that go directly to the artist. That was very cool.
But by the way, that one is an experimental feature with Fountain, our hosting platform. The idea is that we play a song and then we sort of flag the song for the time duration, and any boosts in that period, in theory, should go to the, or 90% should go to the musician. We'll see. Well, if it doesn't, I'll manually forward them. But always happy to try out these new Nostr features.
Yeah, it's great to see the value for value ecosystem growing, more tools every day. So, all right. So, for Avi and any new listeners, we'll start the Bitcoin Gauntlet. And the way this works is Avi will be presented with three categories, all related to Bitcoin and Nostr. Then he'll choose one of those categories, and within there, he'll see three debate prompts. He'll choose one and then decide whether he'd like to argue in the affirmative or the negative for that prompt. We'll have a little bit of a discussion and then we will repeat that for four rounds total. There'll be a little bonus question at the end, and then I'll vibe code Avi a score at the end. All right, so are you ready for the Bitcoin Gauntlet?
I'm ready.
All right. So, round one is adoption, Austrian Economics 1. There'll be an Austrian Economics 2 later, and miscellaneous.
Let's go with adoption.
All right. Number one, Bitcoin will be adopted more slowly than the internet. Two, censorship and surveillance will drive more Bitcoin adoption than inflation will. And three, stablecoin adoption is a net negative for Bitcoin adoption in a given jurisdiction.
No. Very interesting choices here, Tom. Maybe because it's the first round, I'll pick a safer one this time and then maybe get more adventurous for the next round. Let's go with one, which is Bitcoin will be adopted more slowly than the internet, and I will argue for that.
Okay. All right.
So the internet, while it was a radical innovation when it came out, and people started using it in the late 80s, early 90s, but really, mid to late 90s was when adoption, we started seeing the major gains in adoption. And while it was radical in how it reshaped humanity's ability to interact with one another globally, it's still, we're still talking about ideas and information. And I think there's a level of, I guess, less unease, if you will, in being able to, freely communicate your ideas with strangers across the world. In fact, in some sense, the internet gave the ability for people to, if they so chose, to be anonymous, and that allowed them to maybe say things that they wouldn't necessarily say if their actual name and face was attached to that message. So in that sense, it was a much easier medium, to because we're just talking about ideas and thoughts that are being communicated, and so we saw widespread and relatively quick adoption. With Bitcoin, it's while I do believe it will reach that internet level scale at some point, I don't think it's going to be as fast because we're talking about people's personal finances, right? And that there's a lot more friction, I believe, in streamlining human transactions as opposed to human interactions, which is the exchange of ideas, right? Exchange of ideas versus exchange of value. It's that hardwiring that a lot of people have in how they exchange value, whether it's cash or the perceived ease of using credit. I think that barrier will be a lot harder to overcome. It will be overcome, but it's a lot harder to overcome than just, let's say, sending a chat message or an email.
I think there's more, maybe more friction switching over your store value, medium of exchange, unit of account, especially when there's uncertainty and maybe more skin in the game, like whether I use one chat app or another chat app. And I put in a note here, which the audience can't see, but so if we say that the TCP/IP was kind of publicly released by DARPA, the flag day, I think it was January 1st, 1983. So, and Bitcoin is 17 years old. So, if we line those up, I guess we're at year 2000. And I guess the counter argument, counterpoint might be that because we already have the internet, and we have all these other technologies, smartphones, robust infrastructure, that technological advancements happen faster because they piggyback on all these other technologies. And so if you combine that with perhaps a gradually then suddenly model, although that's a bit of a who knows, when that might happen, and the rapid government money printing debasement we're seeing, that there could be a very rapid snowball effect that might surpass the speed of the internet adoption.
Yeah, I mean, again, the one point I'll say, that does make sense, Tom. I don't think the slowness in adoption is a technological barrier, right? I mean, like if you talk to any Bitcoin maxi, such as you or me, And the technology works, right? Bitcoin already is perfect sound money, is the best form of money that humanity has ever seen. And the technology is there to make it a medium of exchange, store of value, even unit of account. So I don't think the barrier is technology. It's human behavior and the human hardwiring. And I think that's what's going to, and that's what has caused the friction. And I suspect that's what's going to slow the adoption compared to the internet.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of Bitcoiners lately have been a little displeased or with the rate of adoption maybe recently. And then yeah, to your point, if you look at the total global wealth, the capital is mostly locked up in all these legacy assets. I mean, at least a third of it is real estate, and that had been kind of the premier store value for millennia, so it's got an extreme Lindy effect in that regard. So that would be a point for why Bitcoin adoption would be very slow to the mindset of humans that land is a better store value than money. So what do you think about maybe one more counter? I mean, I agree with you, so it's difficult for me to come up with counterpoints. What about Bitcoin as a medium of exchange for marketplaces? How much do you think that accelerates adoption versus our standard store value kind of play that we're in still?
Oh, I think that's where it is, right? The Bitcoin being used as money. To me, Bitcoin is money, and in some sense, the story. You know, while we have this well-worn narrative that I think Vijay Boyapathi, in the bullish case for Bitcoin, laid it out, but others have as well, right? Presumably, Saifedean might have as well, which is first store of value, then medium of exchange, then unit of account. But I think really where the magic happens is when you're using it as money. Now you can be pedantic and say, well, storing value is using it as money. But you know, that's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is it how to me adoption is almost synonymous with ubiquity, and ubiquity comes with where you see a QR code. And you just scan it, and boom, the payment's there, or whatever the user experience ends up being. Right now, we're talking about QR codes because that's what we're most familiar with Lightning payments. But whatever that end user experience ends up being, you go to a farmer's market and they accept Bitcoin. You pay, and then that's it. No questions asked, right? No, there's no need to do the conversion. They're holding Bitcoin. They're accepting Bitcoin. So if that becomes widespread, and which is why I think this recent Square announcement, where they rolled out Bitcoin being accepted on any terminal, any Square terminal except in New York, Iran, and North Korea, of course, the three terrorist states. I'm kidding. Iran and North Korea are not terrorist states. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding there as well. But yes, the Square announcement, I think is one of the biggest things to happen to Bitcoin. Now, it's to an extent, it's up to Bitcoiners to now show up at these vendors and merchants who have Square terminals and tell them, hey, you know there is an option, right? And you can accept Bitcoin and it's going to be exactly the same. In fact, better, it's lower fees and fast, presumably slightly faster as well. But I think the medium of exchange is what makes Bitcoin ubiquitous, which to me is synonymous essentially with adoption.
Yeah, I agree. That Square announcement is extremely bullish, and as far as I understand, the merchant can choose what they like to accept, and the exchange is done on the fly. So the person paying can pay in Bitcoin, and they can receive dollars. I think that's correct, when or vice versa. So that's extremely exciting too. They could be using Bitcoin without even realizing they're using Bitcoin. So, all right, let's move on to round two. We have psychology, network slash consensus, and regulation.
Let's go with psychology.
All right. Psychology. Number one, the biggest impediment to understanding Bitcoin is Stockholm syndrome. Number two, ignorance of computers, cryptography, etc. is a bigger barrier to understanding Bitcoin than ignorance of Austrian economics, libertarianism, etc. And three, courage is more important than intelligence for understanding Bitcoin.
So why don't we start with one, which is the biggest impediment to understanding Bitcoin is Stockholm syndrome. Which, and if I understand the question correctly, what you're saying is people are essentially trapped in fiat. The fiat is their abuser, and they have, like Stockholm syndrome, they have sympathy towards their abuser. That's an interesting one. Let me argue against it, and we'll just see by the time I'm done how much I'm actually against than I am for. I might end up convincing myself the other way. But let's start with going against it. When I know you've said understanding Bitcoin, but I'm going to tie this back to the previous topic we were talking about, which is adoption. And to me, there's really there's no functional or no, there's no practical difference between understanding Bitcoin and adopting Bitcoin. Now, again, you can be pedantic and say, there's one is an intellectual realization and the other is the mindful, practical way in which you choose to live your life. As a practical matter, I think they're one just rolls into the other, which is you understand Bitcoin with the idea that you either use it or you don't, right? And I don't think that's what it is. It's not so much Stockholm syndrome. I don't think people feel that they like we'd age tricks, if you will. Man, married man with the family, with the child, the kids aren't adults yet, right? And they're trying to just get by their lives. The man works 9 to 5, presumably. His wife, his spouse works similar hours. Kids go to school. There is just so much that they have to deal with, right? Especially if you're talking about middle class or slightly lower than middle class, that there's no time for philosophical debates for most of these folks, right? These philosophical conversations are almost luxuries that people with time to spare are afforded. If you're someone who has to keep the lights on, make sure that your kids are fed, the lights are on at home, that you can afford your 2 vacations a year to Disneyland or Disney World or whatever it is, it's just being caught up in life. Now, as a Bitcoiner, I would say that what is this life? It is a symptom of late stage fiat, where the reason that both husband and wife, both parents have to work is and as essentially outsource childcare to either the state or a complete stranger, or both, is because they're having to chase these ch chasing inflation, chasing their purchasing power being eroded in real time, and also chasing high time preference behaviors, which are credit-based and debt-based economy invariably produce, which is, I need that 69-inch flat screen TV, or I need that upgrade to my car, or I need this suburban home with these types of fittings. And I think if people had more time, and they weren't so caught up in the rat race, they would be able to take a step back and ask, what do I really want? I want my kids to be happy. I want to be happy. I want to be able to spend time with my partner, go out on dates, have, fun experiences, be a present father, be a present parent, participate in my child's journey into becoming an adult, and then do things that bring meaning and purpose. But because people are in nonstop reactive mode and the high velocity economy that we live in, bombarded by constant comparisons, having to deal with, again, eroding purchasing power, people just don't have the time for this. They're just caught up in their lives. So that's not Stockholm syndrome. I think Stockholm syndrome, in some sense, is almost an acknowledgement that you're a prisoner. And I don't think people believe you're a prisoner, right? They're prisoners, right? They believe this is life and this is what I have to do to live.
Yeah, I guess the distinction. I mean, I'm not a professional psychologist, so I don't know. Maybe whatever it says in the DSM about this, but I was under the impression that Stockholm syndrome was more like you love your captors and you don't see it as an imprisonment. So it depends on which country we're talking about. I mean, if we make it simple and say, the West or the United States, I would say that is the case for everyone. I mean, even Bitcoiners in these places, I would categorize it as kind of an open air prison. And certainly it's been that way at least since World War I and the formation of the central banks that are disconnected from the gold standard. You could argue it has been that way forever. Even in the United States, we rebelled against a tax regime and then quickly reinstalled a tax regime. You could say it's been like that forever. And then to the element that there are captors. The government has been growing and growing, certainly since World War I, taking over more functions for us and removing our autonomy and becoming an authority that does things on our behalf and for us. And so there's this coddling that's been going on for a century where people's personal autonomy has been destroyed. And I see it as that's been so developed that people don't even realize that they even have Stockholm syndrome, that they've crept their way into 1984, without realizing it.
So there's a reason I don't like the prisoner narrative, Tom. And it's there's this personal experience, very recent personal experience of mine that to me reinforces that not liking the prisoner narrative, which is I had a decent fiat job, decent meaning decent paying fiat job until 6 or 7 months ago. But I hated it. I hated every second of it. And for the longest time, I felt like I was trapped. I was a family man. I had to take care of my family. I had to provide. So as a result, this is the sacrifice I had to make. Do something that doesn't inspire me, that doesn't give me any sense of meaning or purpose. That in fact, I wake up every morning hating my day or hating what lay in store for me. And that I was a prisoner and I was trapped. And until one day I woke up and I said, what am I talking about? There is no cage. The only cage is the one that I've created and I hold the key. So I'm just going to walk up and open the lock, open the door and walk out, which is what I did, right? And so to a large extent, I believe these prisons, these metaphorical prisons that we talk about, right? I mean, there is no literal open air prison, right? Like I know you said that. I mean, you could take a flight and go. So, but yes, and you can perceive certain certain things that you see around you as contributing to a prison. But I think the realization that I came to is almost every prison that you think you're in, you've created for yourself. And you have the key to walk out. So we do have an exit, right? The exit exists. You could And especially now with Bitcoin, right? Earlier you were trapped, but in some sense trapped because what would you do with the money? Maybe you'd hoard some cash and then, figure it out. A lot harder. Now it's a lot easier. You need to invest a certain amount of time, accumulate enough savings, and then just walk out. You can move to a farm somewhere and live off the grid if you so chose. You could get on a plane and fly to, there are some territories in the world that perhaps align better with your values as a Bitcoiner than where you are. So no one's stopping you from getting on a flight or a boat or whatever it might be to get there. So to a large extent, the exit exists. Yes, you can always make the case that the government has more guns than you and I ever will. They have the monopoly on violence. They can stop you if it really came down to it. But I don't think that to me is a rarer scenario, right? Than someone saying, "I'm out. I'm done with this coercive, violent society. I'm going off the grid."
I definitely agree. All the tools are there. The freedom tech is there. Bitcoin, Nostr, et cetera, can be readily adopted, and it's a prison for your mind. I guess there's, and yet that being the case, we still haven't seen widespread Bitcoin adoption. At the large population level, we're still quite rare. And I see something about like the personal responsibility of Bitcoin. I guess that's what I was maybe trying to get at before, that adopting Bitcoin takes a lot of personal responsibility, whereas over the last century we've delegated that personal responsibility over to the state, and that somehow taking on that personal responsibility of adopting Bitcoin could trigger a kind of fear response, that it's just, you know what, it's just better if, I just put it into a 401k. I have, managed accounts. The government can always take care of me, despite the fact that we've been so abused by the state. Even though, we're giving them resources, even in spite of the abuse. Okay. Let's move on to round three. We have Bitcoin culture, Austrian economics 2, and geopolitical game theory.
So I'll pick culture because that's my favorite. That's yeah, so, I mean, as I said, I'm an author, I'm a filmmaker, and I host a podcast specifically targeted at Bitcoin culture. So let's do it.
Okay, number one, pragmatist creep over idealism is the biggest threat to Bitcoin. Number two, Bitcoiners are better off not telling anyone they're involved with or hold Bitcoin, i.e., are Bitcoiners. Or number three, if their goal is to grow Bitcoin adoption, Bitcoiners are better off focusing their messaging more on Bitcoin and less on other pop culture issues.
So, could I ask a clarifying question about number three? When you're talking about pop culture issues in the question, right? So, Bitcoin should focus less on pop culture issues. Does that mean, like, don't waste time talking about football or Taylor Swift or that kind of stuff?
I was thinking more about like some of the other things that are popular in Bitcoin, like say like lifestyle stuff, religion, relationship stuff, even like political content, political dynamics, things like that. How to live your life, that kind of deal.
And then pragmatist creep over idealism is the biggest threat to Bitcoin. What is an example of pragmatist creep?
Yeah, so this is a new addition and a little bit of fringe. I took this from a video that Knut shared a couple weeks ago about a long documentary about Dave Smith and the libertarian movement, especially at the political party level. And within the Libertarian Party, there's kind of two camps. One, which Dave Smith, the documentary alleges Dave Smith has been adopting, is that there are certain instances where, you need to violate the non-aggression principle. Things should be done versus maybe the more Ron Paul type, which would be maybe the idealism, which is just speak and hold the line, don't dilute the signal. Isaiah's job, focus on the remnant, and to not deviate from the message and just keep talking, holding the idealism, and then whoever joins, and over time, because it's the correct position, you'll build enough following, and you won't need to
Got it.
dilute the signal.
All right, so I'll take that one and I'll argue for it. I think with one caveat though, Tom, which is, I mean, you call it the biggest threat to pick. I don't know if it's it is a threat. I'll take that track, right? A pragmatist creep over idealism is a threat to Bitcoin. Again, when we say Bitcoin, what we're talking about, Bitcoin adoption, right? Like the Bitcoin permeating through society.
I would maybe caveat that. I would say like Bitcoin as a project, and like Bitcoin's success, like whether, Bitcoin quote unquote dies or not.
So do you mean like so when you say biggest threat to Bitcoin, do you mean the protocol at the protocol level, there could be changes that would then sink it as a technology?
Yeah, let's go with that. Yeah.
Okay.
Whether Bitcoin lives or dies.
Well, so no, suddenly that with okay. Let's do that. I'd actually rather not focus. Again, to me,
Yeah, take your pick.
it's simple, Tom. It's like Bitcoin is about whether it's adopted or not, right? Whether Bitcoin lives or not is about adoption. And I think by arguing that if you maintain our idealism, Bitcoin lives, means the adoption that the way you and I might be talking about it today, or a Bitcoin maxi, talking about it, that's what would continue. So let's go with number one: pragmatist creep over idealism is the biggest threat to Bitcoin. Bitcoiners get accused of being utopians. Of being too idealistic. Oh, well, yes, and this is all anarchists too, right? In some sense, who's going to build the roads? You naive person thinking that, voluntary cooperation is going to solve everything and private, like, yes, but have you looked at the world? Have you looked at people? The people are retarded, that type of argument. And I think if that idealism did not exist, if that general utopianism, utopian type thinking didn't exist, you wouldn't see a lot of the solutions that are being built using Bitcoin, right? There's obviously the protocol itself, but let's just set that aside for a second. I'm talking about what people are doing by building solutions on top of Bitcoin, and including Nostr, by the way, right? Nostr, Cashew, all Lightning, the vendors who are accepting Bitcoin, the physical embassies that are coming up, like PubKey, like the Cypherpunk House in London, like Bitcoin Park, and others. It is a sense of idealism and believing that a more just and peaceful society can exist. That's driving a lot of these initiatives. It is the idealists who think the world can be a better place, who want to be the change that they want to see in the world, right? Instead of complaining about it, that are taking these steps. And I think the danger with pragmatism, and I don't want to just dis pragmatism in its entirety, but what I'm trying to say here is there is a slippery slope here, right? When you if you compromise certain principles, so that example you gave, I don't know if it is a verbatim quote of Dave Smith, where there are times when the non-aggression principle can be violated. There is a, it's to me, right, that doesn't make any sense. There is a condition baked into the non-aggression principle. You defend, you can defend yourself, right? That is very much a part of, so what does violation of the non-aggression principle mean? It means, I guess, preemptive violence, right? That's what that means to me. Because not the non-aggression principle never says that you can never, you should always be non-violent. It's you don't, you're, no, it's you're not preemptively non-violent. So I think that there is a risk that if people start bringing in those types of compromises, well, self-custody, do you really need self-custody? Or why don't you just put it in ETF? Now, there's a bit of a nuance here, though, Tom, right? Because you have really good solutions like Cashew and even Custodial Lightning, which to me makes sense for very small amounts, just to facilitate easy, like for Nostr Zapps, for instance, right? There are Primal, which offers a custodial Lightning wallet. And by the way, there's a limit to how many sats you can have in that, right? And they've Primal has very intentionally put that limit on it because it is a custodial wallet. But I think there are small compromises that you can make, which is why I said that there's a nuance, right? If you're zapping, if you're using a Nostr zapping wallet to send someone, you know, a buck or 5 or 10 bucks to boost them on Fountain, their podcast or their song on Fountain, I think there's a line there where you can where it's okay, right? Just keep as how much cash would you carry with you in your wallet? 20 bucks, maybe $100, whatever that number is, right? You wouldn't walk around with $20,000 in your wallet, for example, right? So in your physical wallet, that's what I mean, in cash. So I think that there's obviously a number that's a comfort level for everyone. Could be $20, it could be $100, for which solutions like eCash and Custodial Lightning offer more benefit at those levels than harm. What I was talking about is the recent narrative that's going around saying, well, all you really care about Bitcoin is the exposure to the price. So why do you need custody at all? It's such a headache, hardware wallets, so on and so forth. Just park it in an ETF or park it in a treasury stock, and that'll give you the exposure to the price, right? Those types of quote unquote pragmatic concerns, of pragmatic suggestions, right? Oh, leave it to the experts on Wall Street. They know more about this stuff than you do. You'll get your exposure, you'll get your number go up. I think. So those types of things, I think, absolutely erode the culture and the values of Bitcoin, and Bitcoin stops being the revolution that some of us believe it's going to be.
Yeah, I guess over the years I've deleted the word inevitable, I think, from my vernacular here. And I like to think of something Knut says, which is that something like Bitcoin is people agreeing on a fixed set of rules. So that being the case, I've somewhat deleted the my beliefs about Bitcoin's inevitability, that it's also ultimately dependent upon human action. Now, our belief is that the rules are so perfectly balanced that Bitcoin will sustain itself forever. It doesn't need to, and to quote maybe Tomer, Bitcoin doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to last forever. So that being said, I have a question maybe we can pivot to, which is how do you strike the balance between, nudging people to one of your recent sermons? Versus, not being a pragmatist, especially maybe if say for friends and family, like how much damage is there if you're like, okay, this person is just getting started. Do we start with just having them convert some fiat and keep it on the exchange just for now? Or like, What's the balance there between being like, no, you need to get it into self custody immediately, and how do you go about that on like a real interpersonal level when you're dealing with people one on one?
So I'll go back to a time when I was in grad school, and I used to how I paid the bills when I was in grad school was I used to tutor undergrads, calculus and pre-calculus. And when I initially started off as a calculus tutor, I would sit with them and try and derive everything from first principles. And before they even started their first problem, right? Like I would go to the foundation of it. I wouldn't make a single statement unless it was absolutely back. There was a foundational axiom and then deductive reasoning that got from point A to point B, and it was a nightmare. No one was getting it. They were getting stuck on the nuances. We were getting into philosophical debates. So I quickly and ultimately, why did they want calculus tutoring so that they could do well on their exam? So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I'll give you some basic foundational questions, and I will tell you to use this little trick. Use this trick; it'll get you the answer. As you get more answers, you'll start having more questions. You'll come back to me and you'll ask me, and then I'll fill in the blanks. This was a roaring success, by the way, right? So there was an element of, look, trust me on this. Just do this; it'll get you to the answer. Use this trick the next few times. Just get used to what's happening. And then that's going to, once you start identifying more of these patterns, you'll come back with more questions, then I'll answer them. What ended up happening is eventually they understood the first principles, but it started with them taking these little shortcuts with me saying, trust me. So they did that. And then they'd come back and say, hey, I've been doing this a few times. Why exactly are we following this pattern here? I'd say, well, that's because this principle leads to this and this and this. And they say, oh, now it all makes sense to me. And they ended up, all of them ended up doing really well on their exams. So I think that was a very useful learning experience for me. And this is when I was in grad school. So I was in my early 20s. So a valuable foundation for how I then set about teaching. Not that I became a teacher, but whenever the opportunity presented itself. And I think I using that type of approach makes sense in Bitcoin as well, which is you introduce them, especially someone who's completely new to this, who might not be a technologist, who's really not that curious about Austrian economics or decentralization and all of this other stuff, but just their curiosity has been piqued a little bit by this. I think I start them off simple, right? It's the give them, 10,000 sats or whatever it is, right? And get them set up on a simple lightning wallet. And Nostr is a great way of onboarding people, by the way, right? Because out of the box, you're up on custodial lightning. You're dealing with small amounts, right? People rarely zap more than the equivalent of a buck or two on post. So, yeah, so just get people set up simply, and then if that number goes up, right, and let's say they've been immersed in this for a while, and zapping, re bo getting boosts, sending zaps back, receiving zaps, then it's time for that second conversation, which is, hey, so you see what's happening here, and you see the dollar amount, so you can see the corresponding dollar amount. Now, when this number gets large enough, you don't want to keep it all here. You move it to a more secure place. And I think that is the right time to have, I found anyway, to have that conversation rather than overwhelming them with everything first principles on day one.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I like that step-by-step approach, and maybe asking questions too. Like little things, maybe like why pay taxes when they can print money. Maybe little things like that to get them to maybe come to the answers themselves, instead of just being like, here's a bunch of Rothbard. Go read it. So, all right. Let's go on to round four. We have Noster, mining, and protocol changes.
I think you know which one I'm choosing here, Tom. It's going to be Nostr.
Yes, absolutely. All right, Noster. We have fiat celebrities using Noster will drive mainstream Noster adoption more than censorship on legacy social media will. Two, Nostr will be mass adopted before Bitcoin. Or three, the biggest risk to Nostr is that it will fall into the same centralization trend as email and other internet protocols.
So let's go with number one. Fiat celebrities using Nostr will drive mainstream Nostr adoption more than censorship and that, right? There's a small asterisk to my argument, even though I'm arguing for, but we'll get. But let's get into it. I think if you think about adoption, and we could have talked about this when we were talking about Bitcoin adoption as well. Why do people generally you do things, right? It's because there is, again, I'm not talking about the handful of Bitcoiners who adopted Bitcoin or the early adopters of Bitcoin on Nostr, who might have been driven in, brought in by things like the beauty of the protocol design or stuff like that. Most people do things because they find some kind of emotional connection with that thing they do, right? But either it makes them happy or makes them less sad, or it's fun or whatever it might be, right? Or they're acting from a place of fear. They're scared that something's going to happen to them, so they want to find safety. The vast majority of people adopt different ways of being, ways of life, including technologies, because of an emotional connection, as opposed to a purely intellectual realization, right? Now, of course, there are exceptions. I think early Bitcoin adopters, early Nostr adopters are that. So, in the case of Nostr, what do I think is going to drive more adoption is people realizing that Nostr is the most fun place on the internet. That there are like this, there's, I logged into Instagram, all I'm seeing is rage bait. I logged into Twitter, all I'm seeing is people being beheaded and people yelling at each other. Well, look at these people. They're posting memes. They're posting songs. They're sending themselves a couple of cents per song, and they just seem to be having a good time. I want a piece of that. Oh wow, this celebrity that I like is now posting his or her music or their podcast on Fountain on Nostr. Yeah, I want to see why they've gone there and why they're talking about that, right? That is, to me, it will by far drive more adoption because people are largely emotional beings, and they and cultural things are what draw them into a new way of being. That's not to say that censorship events won't lead to some adoption. And we've, in the 3 years that Nostr has been around, and I say 3 years, it's 3 years post the Jack Dorsey wave, right? I mean, Nostr was around before that, but not that many people used it. We've seen a few censorship events, like the TikTok ban. I think Brazil had a Twitter ban and some, yeah, there were some other things, two or three other things as well. People came. Some people came for a few days from those places. They checked it out and they didn't stick around, and they left. And I think if you're trying to appeal to people's intellect by saying, "Look at this decentralization, you're signing events and you're sending them to this distributed set of computers known as relays, and only you own your signature and all of that stuff," it's going to fall on deaf ears, or it's going to go right over their head. If you tell them, "Hey, your favorite musician is here, she's putting up her music, you can send her money, it won't go to the platform, most of it will go straight to her, almost nothing will go to the platform, unlike the other way around on Spotify, where or whatever other fiat platform there is, when Spotify takes most of the money, right? So it's a chance for you to directly support. You can even engage with your favorite celebrity, and they tend to reply back. People will come for stuff like that. They won't. So you'll see far more people running to Nostr over the long term rather than running away from something, and they happen to run into Nostr in the process.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think? Well, I don't know if this assessment is correct, but what do you think might explain why we haven't seen more celebrities or maybe even popular people who have been censored in fiat world not start using Nostr. And as a side question, it seems like Nostr adoption has slowed down a little bit. I mean, I know it's a little bit difficult to get metrics on this, but it seemed like it's flatlined a little bit. So what do you think's been going on in those two
I
aspects?
think, yeah, one of the challenges is it's mostly Bitcoiners on Nostr, right? Now, there are other communities. And there are a lot of Bitcoiners who speak their own language, who have their own code words, their own slang. And when someone new comes in, they could feel excluded or completely not understand what on earth's happening. And I think it's not up to the people on Nostr to change how they behave, the people who are enjoying themselves on Nostr, like myself, by the way. I have a great time every day. Personally, in fact, I've seen my Nostr usage go up in the last couple of months. Yes, I agree, it went down. It felt like it went down prior to that, but it ebbs and flows. In any event, it should be up to people like me or others. That we have to change our behaviors or have to change what we talk about, so that other people can feel more welcome. Now, that could be a choice someone makes if they really want to. But the reason I came to Nostr was because Twitter was hell. I hated it. Right? I was screaming into the void. Every time I replied to something, people would try to dunk, and it was a terrible culture. And when I tried to get some engagement on Twitter, I had to be someone else, right? And I didn't like it one bit. So I came to Nostr because I could be myself, and I would have real conversations with real people. And a large part of, for me personally, being myself is talking about the things I want to talk about, which Bitcoin happens to be a large part of it, right? I don't think it's incumbent on the people who are there, unless they, out of the goodness of their hearts, choose to do so, to talk about topics that bring other people in, which then leads you to the dilemma of, well, then how do people feel included? How do the people feel welcome, outsiders, right, who have no interest in Bitcoin? And I think the way to break out of that is to find little nodes and little circles. So you find one. What is the right word? I don't want to say influencer because that's not what I'm trying to say, but maybe one creator with a large enough circle who you can convince on the properties of Nostr. It cannot be an influencer actually, because influencers, like in the I guess the current sense of the word, are people who know how to game the algorithm. Their livelihood base is based on these fiat algorithms, right? So it needs to be someone who's actually open and curious and who's willing to have authentic conversations, and they have a large enough following. Is to find them, try to convince them to move to Nostr, and then talk about whatever they want to talk about. And if they can pull a small segment of their circle, their audience with them, that's how we create these different communities, right? So you could have one for writing, you could have one for music, for film, and so on and so forth. We're seeing a few ripples of these today, Tom. I would, for anyone who's getting frustrated at the pace of Nostr adoption, I would urge some patience, because these things take time. The technology is only improving, right? There, a lot of things today, and I'm in mid-December 2025, are a lot easier to do than they were in June of 2025. Right. We have live streaming now across multiple clients on Nostr. And what do I mean by that? Anyone can spin up a live stream, put it in one place on Nostr, like zap.stream. That gets picked up on Primal. That gets picked up on Amethyst, on this new app called Nostria, on Fountain even, all because of the magic of an open protocol. So that didn't exist 6 months ago, right? That the ability for live streams to be broadcast organically across the network. So we have things like that are coming. Fountain, we mentioned at the top of the show, has just rolled out this feature where I can isolate the track in my so I can play independent artists on my podcast. I can isolate the time and set a zap split or a boost split for that artist in just in that localized time where the music is playing, and then 90% of the sats that get zapped during the song's duration go to them, right? So these are new features that are constantly coming out. Some work, some don't work. People go back to the drawing board. They build more things. So if anyone's getting frustrated with the rate of Nostr adoption, I would urge patience and to look at the bigger picture of how these features are being rolled out. Two is I would say go and engage yourself and have fun, right? Don't worry about adoption. Are you having a good time? Focus on yourself and do that. And then three, I would say, is a bit of a shameless plug for my company, Nos Fabrica. We are building Web of Trust solutions for Nostr, open source commons, where which are designed to improve discoverability. There's not going to be a centralized entity providing a score. These are like you as a user will have your perspective through your web, through your connections on different types of music, on food, on podcasts, and so on. And you can curate your own experience. Now, these things take time to build. And hopefully in the next 2 or 3 months, we'll start rolling out some of these initial prototypes. So Web of Trust is going to fix a lot of things. There are many things coming down the pike, like these marketplaces, decentralized marketplaces where anyone can list anything. And then again, based on Web of Trust, you as a user can choose which vendor you go to buy. I don't know whether you want organic, grass-fed colostrum, for instance, and you can get that.
Yeah, there's always so much going on at Nostr. It's extremely bullish. It's hard to keep up with everything that's going on. Certainly don't get to use every single thing that's being built. So that's extremely exciting. And yeah, the marketplaces as well. That seems like it was the initial dream of the cypherpunks, maybe more so even than the money. I know a lot of people say that the money was the holy grail, but I think maybe the money was just a means to an end to achieve the peer-to-peer decentralized marketplaces. That was like the ultimate end state. And
The
then,
biggest bug of Silk Road was that there was just one of them, right? And Nostr fixes that. You can have infinite marketplaces because each product listing is just an event, is a Nostr event that lives on relays. You just create a storefront, use your trust filters to pick out these events and list whatever you want. And depending on the experience that you as a storefront, Nostr storefront create, you'll get your users. And these products and these buyers and sellers, they exist irrespective of whether the storefront exists or not, right? So I think this solves the Silk Road problem in two ways. One is through Web of Trust, you can filter out the quote unquote bad stuff. And the other is if someone tries to shut you down, well, all they've done is shut you down. That 20 other market and the Nostr event lives forever anyway.
yeah, it's great. I love the Nostr marketplaces. I think I've used Plebeian Market and Shopster so far. It's pretty cool. And then maybe one more thing to the prompt explicitly. I wanted to say I'm surprised that we haven't seen any fiat celebrities or undesirables that are popular who've been banned from YouTube or Twitter or anywhere, that they haven't figured out that you can just use Nostr. I mean, I think there was a period where maybe Kanye was banned, and I don't know. I was pretty optimistic maybe someone would tell him to figure out that he could even, spin up your own relay. I mean, even if the other relays don't like you and they boot you off, you could just spin up your own relay. So I'm surprised, especially when it comes to like a value for value thing, that they could have this censorship resistant way to reach their audience as well as get income. So I'm surprised by that.
I'm not entirely surprised, Tom. Well, I'm surprised that there hasn't been one or two at least, but I'm not surprised that there
Yeah, there
hasn't been
hasn't
any.
been any, really.
And I'll tell you why I'm not entirely surprised by this, because I still think vast majority of the so-called creators, right, want to be influencers, and they get banned there. So their entire worldview is, I mean, they are creatures of the algorithm, right? They were created by the algorithm. They learn how to game it, and they build their following based on gaming that algorithm. And you know, for the most part, the algorithm does not allow you to be authentic. You have to play a part. You have to be someone else. And Nostr, that just does not fly, right? The most successful people on Nostr are the most authentic people. Largely, I think, driven by the chronological feed, right? The chronological fire hose that Nostr is. So, you know, it's only authenticity that wins. And I think a majority of the influencers who've been cast out of the fiat platforms, they don't know how to be authentic because they were born of the algorithm. Now, having said that, why not even one or two authentic people who were cast out? Maybe the word didn't get to them, right? Maybe it's as simple as that. This is a niche community as things stand today.
Yeah, it can be arcane, and there are the other more popular options that are definitely not decentralized. So maybe they have only heard about those, and maybe they go there. And yeah, so Nostr is still a very small community, so nobody in their camp maybe hasn't heard of Nostr. So all right, so that concludes the rounds of Bitcoin Gauntlet, but we do have a bonus question, which I know the listeners can't see, but I have it here. My hat here. The question is, where does the yield come from? From friend of the show, Alan Farrington. Alan is always welcome on the show. So, yeah, bonus points for any funny answers, novel answers, answers I
Yeah.
haven't heard before. Where does the yield come from?
Yeah, I will paraphrase Hemingway's "For Whom the Bell Tolls," right? Ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for you. Ask not from where the yield comes, for it comes from you.
Excellent. That's definitely the most philosophical answer I've ever heard. I've usually had some more cynical answers, more finance related answers. So thank you for that. I love it. And so now let's see if I can construct a score for Avi. Well done. And I think the only appropriate score would have to be, without a doubt, 24, in honor of your first book and book series. So well done. And yeah, what's the latest with your latest book? I know it just came out recently, is that right?
Yeah, it's a continuation of it picks up 1 week after 24 left off in the timeline. If you have the time, I can give a super quick summary of what the story is. And
Yeah, absolutely.
well, so 24 is a story of a young man who's almost 24, whose father suddenly passes away, and this young man, through a series of psychic visions, finds that his father actually left behind a secret, a 24-word secret, which he now needs to figure out what it even means. What is it, a sentence? Is it something else? It's a 24-chapter book. Each chapter is how he finds each word. And as you can imagine, as any Bitcoiners listening to this can imagine, it's somewhere along the journey he realizes what those 24 words mean. And then towards the end of the book, it's not just him coming to terms with the grief of his father's passing, the five stages of his grief. It's also the five stages of his Bitcoin maximalism as he goes through that journey. And then there's a twist at the end of 24, well, I don't want to say any more, but July 18 picks up there as this young man then unravels this twist that appears in 24. And I think in some sense, 24 was my first novel, and it was more a story about how a young man becomes a Bitcoiner, but of course deals with a very human condition of grief for a loved one. The erasure of a past almost in some sense. So it is that, but I think July 18 is a far deeper exploration of the human condition, because I was no longer constrained, if you will, by needing to make this man a Bitcoiner. He already was a Bitcoiner at the start of July 18, so I could really explore other aspects of his psyche.
Yeah, that sounds great. Definitely everybody check out Avi's books. Check out Plebchain Radio. And thank you for doing the gauntlet, Avi. I appreciate it. You did great. And last word is yours if you'd like to tell people about anything else you're working on or where they can find your work.
Well, first of all, appreciate you having me on, Tom. Yeah, I enjoyed this. It's certainly a novel format, choose your own adventure. I think more podcasts should take this slight interactive approach, almost like a random walk through a podcast, if you will. So, yeah, really appreciate this. If you want to read 24, oh, by the way, 24, the second edition is out now. As of a day or two ago, it has some minor changes. The story is still the same. So you can go to Amazon, search for 24 Avi Burra or July 18 Avi Burra. That's how you get my books. You can find my show, Finding Home, on IndieHub, IndieHub dot studio. Just go there, go to the series or episodic tab, and you'll see Finding Home. There's two episodes right now. The third episode, I filmed it in Paraguay. That should be out in about 3 weeks, and then the fourth episode, which I just wrapped up filming in the UK, will be out sometime in March. You can find Plebchain Radio on any podcasting app of your choice. And if you're on Nostr, you can find me at primal.net/Avi, AVI.
Great. Thanks, Avi.
Thank you, Tom.